Hi, everybody. We're going to get started here with the second talk of the day. This time we're going to be talking specifically about data storage options in Azure. One of the things that you probably picked up from the first session is once you deploy a solution that is pretty much read-only. There's not a whole lot you could do with it. So obviously you need a place to store all your data. And what we're going to talk about here are some of your options for doing that. So my name is Brian. I'm a developer evangelist. I'm a colleague of Joe's. I'm up in the Carolinas area, so it's we're still all here in the South. So it's kind of good to head down here and have a little bit warmer weather. Although Joe tells me that it's cold for down here, I'll have a hard time believing that. But I'm really excited about Azure and anything web development. You know, every once in a while, technology comes along that you really personally get vested in. And for me, Azure is one of those technologies, so I really like it. And it's a good one to dive into. So my contact info is up here, and I will go ahead and put that up at the end. Now, anybody remember this project? Is anybody still doing this? All right. Well, what this is kind of funny. I started thinking about what got me excited about cloud computing, and I started thinking about things that I've done in the past. And in the mid-90s, I used to use SETI at home, and I realized that it's still alive. You can still do it, which is pretty cool. Is anybody still using SETI at home right now? You get a laptop if you are. No, just kidding. Get Joe's laptop. So SETI at home, for those who aren't familiar with this, SETI at home is a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and it was a project started a long time ago. The idea was is that I forgot the team behind it. It was just the SETI team would record all the passive radio signals coming off of they would capture from the radio telescopes like Arecibo, and they needed to crunch it to try to find patterns that would recognize extraterrestrial intelligence. And they didn't have the computing power to do it, so they created this distributed computing project. And it was the idea was you would launch a screensaver, and it would crunch the data. And the coolest thing about this was this idea, well, there are two cool things, right? Cool thing number one is just it has to do with outer space, and as a geek, anything outer space is just cool. But number two was you're participating in this large, geographically load balanced solution to get everything, you know, to participate in that. And you've got all these other people doing the same thing, and you get competitions going. And there's also a couple of other projects out there. Another big one is folding at home, doing protein folding. So if you don't want to search for extraterrestrials and instead do something like cure cancer, you could do something like that. So this led me to a project that I started a number of years ago. The idea was I wanted to take visitors to my website and figure out where they were coming from. And part of it was just a programming challenge for myself to figure this thing out and to take an IP address off of a log file and then plot it on a map. So I did that, put this thing live, and pretty soon started seeing all these visitors coming in. It was really cool and really made me think, gosh, I wonder what that person there and, you know, wherever was, what they're doing on my site and so on. So it was really kind of an interesting project, and this led to the MyWorldMaps.net application, and we were showing you some of that Silverlight app that shows you traffic in real time in the breaks. And you can go up there today and get an account if you'd like. So that's a little bit of background on me, and some of the numbers from Microsoft that are a little bit more interesting. If you see here, 1 billion Windows Live ID authentications each day. I mean, that's just massive, and we see some of these numbers, and it's almost mind-boggling that all this is going on every day. So the infrastructure needed to support this, it's just really cool. So Joe already showed you our data centers, currently 6 online. The ones that I'm mostly focusing on here are in the United States. The two that we have we refer to as North Central and South Central. North Central is in Chicago and South Central is in San Antonio. And you saw some of these pictures of these containers, but we're just going to jump right in. I'll show you there's some traditional rack space in these data centers, but the more interesting thing are those containers that they bring in that have a couple thousand servers per container. You can stack them too high, put 50 plus in a data center, and you have this instant compute ability, because all of a sudden you can very quickly, in less than a day, bring an entire container online. And when you consider what's necessary for hooking all of that up, network, cooling, power, to get that many servers, you know, it could take me all day to get one online in my home. So, but that's pretty cool to see that. And it also allows the data centers to have this great scalability as well. And it's very modular, so if servers start dropping in one particular container, there's actually no need to go crawling in there and ripping it out. They could just remove it from service, right? Just like marking a sector as bad on your hard disk and just not use it anymore, and they can replace the entire container if need be. So it's really interesting. There's another look. And inside, Joe showed you one of these pictures earlier as well, what it looks like inside one of these things. And I said to these guys, you know, we got a tour, and we were walking around. I said, you know, I've only got a couple of instances of my site running, but I want you to show me which server my stuff is running on. I want to see it. So they took me in the back room and showed me this. So actually, I grabbed this picture. This is the actual laptop computer. Hard to believe that's a laptop, but that was Anders' computer that we built the Turbo Pascal compiler on. So it was just kind of a funny picture. He recently sold that. I don't know if it was him directly selling it. I think it was one of the museums or something that had that computer. Just sold it off of eBay for a few thousand dollars. But anyway, I saw that picture and thought it was funny. So what are the storage options then in Azure? You really have a few. The big one that we seem to have a lot of questions around was SQL Azure. And that's obviously a big one for us because as developers today, almost any dynamic ASP.NET website is probably going to be using SQL Server in some capacity. So SQL Azure is a big one, and I'll show you how to do that. And the other ones are blobs, tables, queues, and drives. Now, I won't focus too much on drives because drives is really an abstraction on top of blobs. But blobs, tables, and queues are essentially what we call the native Azure storage options. And what they are is they're services that you can use to store tabular data, to store binary data, to store queues, which is really just a buffered, durable delivery mechanism for messages, just like MSMQ. And the point here would be to, you can leverage those within your applications. And everything in Azure Storage is completely REST-based using ADO.NET Data Services. So if you've played with it before, you understand how everything is very simple, access via HTTP. However, you don't want to be necessarily coding all this HTTP directly inside your applications. So we have a storage client that you can use. It's built into the Azure SDK. As a matter of fact, it was a sample not too long ago, but it was such a popular sample for how to wrap all these HTTP calls that they had built it directly into the platform. So what we'll do there is use that storage client to then wrap all these calls to blobs, tables, and queues. So we'll get into this as well. Now with drives allows you to take a VHD file, same VHDs you're already going to be using locally. You can either have them created already that you're using, or you can have the drive classes create one for you, and then you can store that VHD file inside blob storage, and then you can mount that drive directly from your application and use it. And there's a few advantages and a few challenges you have to overcome with that, and we'll hopefully get time to go into some of those as well. So one of the first topics we're going to get into, and I have a guest speaker I'll introduce in just a minute, are some of the features in SQL Azure. And Joe went into these before. For the most part, a lot of what I call the basic stuff is supported. In fact, I have not had an issue. I tend to keep my SQL very, very lean, using only basic insert and updates and joins and all of that. I really have not had a problem migrating anything to SQL Azure. If you are using, for example, CLR or some of the other features like, reporting services or analysis servers, those things are not yet supported. Now, some of them, like reporting services, will be supported in time. I don't have a time frame, but they will be coming. So we'll get into some more specifics over time. But one of the things that I wanted to do was give a little bit of a history behind SQL Azure because it's kind of interesting. In fact, anybody attend the MSDN event we had about a year ago where we had a session on Azure? I know I probably can't remember and I was presenting on it, but one of the sessions that we had dealt with what we called SQL Data Services or SDS. And this is always, people always ask me, you know, now you've got SQL Azure, what happened to SDS and what's going on there? So I thought a little bit of a history would help clear some of this up. So back in 2005, we had a CloudDB team form. Their real mission there was to take the SQL Server kernel and figure out a way to scale it out in such a way to support cloud-based solutions. And the first thing that they came up with, both internally and externally, was this property bag model that you see there on the left of the screen, where you had an external application that could, over REST, access a database. And it was pretty cool, and it was codenamed Sitka, and that ultimately became called SQL Data Services, or SDS. The problem was nobody really liked that very much, because it was a completely different paradigm to deal with SDS than it was to deal with local SQL Server. And people said, I just want to change my connection string and have it work. I don't want to have to re-architect my entire solution. So the team heard that messaging loud and clear, and still using the same CloudDB infrastructure, completely re-engineered the front end to it to accept ADO and ODBC and OLADB over TDS, and now we can connect. So in many, many cases, it is very simple to just have that type of change your connection string, and it just works. And we'll show you some examples of that today. So what I'll do is, before I show you my app in progress, we have a guest speaker here today. Hervé Ruggiero is here. Now, he is in the process of writing a SQL Azure book. He knows more about SQL Azure than I do. And he's a managing partner. And I'll just let him go into some of his qualifications, but we had dinner last night and had some really great conversations about some of this technology and where it's going and how it can be used. So he has some great insights. So if you have any questions, it would be a great opportunity while he's here to ask them. But I'll just turn it over to you, Hervé, and have at it.
All right. Thank you very much, Brian. Can you hear me in the back? Am I on?
No.
No? Yes, I'm on, right? Yes. All right, perfect. Thank you very much. My name is Hervé Ruggiero, and I'm really happy to be here today. I'm going to be talking about SQL Azure for about 20 minutes or so. Before I dive into Azure, my company specializes in SQL Server security and performance. When I attended that meeting last year, the MSDN presentation and SDS, I really wasn't sure what to do with it. And then as soon as I heard a SQL Server was going to be on the cloud, I thought, oh, that's it. I've got to jump on this. This is going to be really cool. And it is. It really didn't disappoint. Scott and I are, Scott is here, Scott Klein, MVP in SQL Server, and I are writing a book on SQL Azure. We'll be coming out by the August timeframe. We finished chapter 2. Yeah. Last week. And actually, as I was writing this chapter on design, I really had an opportunity to step back and think, wow, you can do a lot of stuff with SQL Azure. And, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about how it works and how you can use it, and then we'll do some of that. But I really encourage you to look at SQL Azure and the Azure Cloud Services in general on what you can do with it from your own business standpoint, and how it can help you solve certain type of problems that you really couldn't solve today. And I'm going to try to show you a little bit of that today, but there's really a lot of stuff that's available to you. Part of it is understanding what are some of the key things that you can do, the limitations in SQL Azure, but also how to game the system a little bit. What are the parameters and the boundaries that are there? And once you understand them, you can better design, your system. And we'll go into that a little bit more later. We also run the local SQL Server user group. So if you're interested in how to join in Miramar and West Palm Beach, I've got some business cards here. You can come and grab one. All right. So as mentioned earlier, Joe, mentioned that SQL Azure was actually kept from a high availability standpoint. You had multiple databases in the back being kept. You don't really have access to those. You don't see them. They're managed automatically for you. But when you think about a database server, that's gone. This concept of having a database server in the cloud is really incorrect. It's really nothing more than a logical name. So you connect to a logical instance of SQL, which is nothing more than a proxy. And then at this point, when you say, I want to connect to this specific database, now you're going to be pointing to an actual physical server which hosts that database. But if you want to connect to another database and you create database 1 and database 2, database 2 may be located in a totally different server. And so what you see here is you're connecting to a logical database, and that database is going to be managed and copied over on different servers automatically for you. So if anything happens to it, you're going to be connecting to another database, a copy of that database on a different, totally different database server. But to you, it's the same logical server name, if you will. So it's totally transparent to you. This is managed in the back. And this is really what one of the reasons why you are, Microsoft is able to provide a high availability on SQL Server. So as we've talked about earlier already, there's a bunch of things you can do. It's all CRUD-related, create, read, update, delete. You see how a few things that are available. The constraints are really important. You have to create, you can create your cursors. I don't particularly like cursors, but you can definitely do that. You can create your views, triggers, store procs. And store procedures are going to be really important from a design standpoint as well. We'll talk about that soon. There's certain things you must do. And you must, from a security standpoint, you must define firewall rules so that you can actually connect your database if you've got a remote instance. So I had to actually physically go earlier and set up a rule so that I could connect from this laptop in this location to my own SQL Server database. So that when you create your SQL Server, because it's exposed on the internet, you don't want anybody, connecting from Europe or South Africa or wherever. You need to turn on those rules to be able to say, I'm allowing this IP range to connect to my SQL Server, Azure SQL Server. You don't have today the ability to connect to SSPI. You must connect with a database credential. Because this is a shared environment, you can't really do anything you want. You can't, set up this huge store proc with ten thousands of lines of code that's going to do a bunch of cursors, nested loops, and, create all these huge CPU spikes and consume all those database resources. You're going to get kicked out. I mean, your process will be killed. So there are certain things that you need to understand from a, what you can do from a performance standpoint, where if you don't pay attention to the performance of your database activity, you will lose connection. And in fact, because you're over the wire and you're basically connecting to the internet, you may lose connection for, many different reasons. And that kind of implies that in your code, when you connect to SQL Azure, you will probably need to account for automatic database reconnections. You have to create a clustered index. You cannot just create a table. You cannot create a heap table. You have to create a clustered index on your table so that your data is properly organized. And that's probably one of the key reasons and a key requirement to be able to maintain those replica databases in the back. And we talked about earlier about the things you cannot do, such as mirroring, and all of that is taken away from you. And I kind of look at SQL Azure as this Pearl Harbor movie at the end, where they try to remove all those things from the airplane, right? So, we've got to get rid of this. We've got to cross the Atlantic and so on, Pacific, and we've got to remove this, we've got to remove that, and all these three tanks we don't need. This is pretty much what's happening when you look at SQL Server and SQL Azure. A bunch of stuff were removed so that you can actually scale. So all of the things that could really bring down your SQL Server performance were removed initially. Backups, .NetCLR, service broker, all the things that are not directly related to the database, and it kind of makes sense. Kind of first release, right? And then slowly those things are probably going to get back into the services. Some of them will, but carefully. So there are really two ways you can connect. I'll leave it right there. There are a couple of things. Very quickly, there are two ways you can connect your SQL Azure instances. is to, from within the Windows Azure environments, and you can establish a connection from there, or you can connect to your from a remote application that from your desktops or servers in your own infrastructure and open a direct database connection, and that's a straight TCP connection on port 1433. You cannot change that. You can change ports for HTTP on Windows Azure, but right now for SQL Azure, you have to connect over port 1433. All right. So there's a question in the back. Yes. So the question is, can you create a database? Yes. Yeah, so you can use T-SQL statements to create databases, yes. But you cannot detach and attach databases. Well, you've got alter, you've got a bunch of commands that are available. In fact, books online, an SDN has the list of all of the T-SQL commands that are fully supported, partially supported, and not supported at all. There's quite a few commands you can use, yeah. Yeah, any other questions? Sounds good. All right, let's take a look at an example.
If you need anything.
Is that? So the first example we're going to look at is a website that I quickly built. Okay. So this is an example of connecting to SQL Azure from a web application that's deployed in Azure. And the way I did this is, you know, I'm kind of lazy a little bit, so I thought, oh, okay, instead of recreating all this code, and it's going to be the same database, right? So I'm going to create a DLL, and my web application is going to connect to the database through my DLL, right? Kind of a logical three-tier, if you will. And what I have here is my TechBio DLL with a single class, which really manages the connection to the database and knows how to create or search specific records in the database. So my code is really super simple. Nothing's going on. That's unusual. Right? I basically establish a connection, which looks like a regular connection I've got. It inherits from C database. And that's my connection string. Right. So I issue a open a SQL connection object, a command object. I specify my store proc, and then I connect to it and issue my statements. I mean, it's all the same, typical code, except now that it's in a DLL. Right. A note about design. So I've got an option, especially on the search engines. You know, if I need to search for profiles, which I'm going to show you in a sec. I could either pull the data over and do some crunching, or I could actually create a store proc and do the search and create a SQL code to do the search on a database. So what you're paying for, pricing comes into play, right, from design decisions. What you're paying for is the data transfer piece, unless with the exception of if you do a local SQL Azure, Windows Azure connection to your database. But outside of that, you're going to pay for the transfer of the data. So you have the choice of transferring everything and doing the data crunching on your local app server, or you call a store proc that does the crunching for you and just return the results. So you pay for the data transfer, but you don't pay for the CPU activity. So then suddenly it becomes interesting to leverage store procs because you're not going to pay for all the work you're doing. However, you might be throttled. Throttled in that context means you might have a kill connection if you consume way too many CPU resources or IO resources or memory resources. So you're being watched. You can't just do, you know, and pull all your stuff on the CPU like this. But you can definitely do some work in there and monitor that. So what this means really is that doing performance tuning starts and has to start in development. You have to look at it in your development environment, make sure it works well, that it's tuned properly before you put it in a SQL Azure environment. All right. At this point, This DLL here, I'm going to show you another app, which is a client Windows application. And the design of this application is that the web application, the web app allows people to download their bios. Hey, this is what I do. It's not a resume, it's shorter, right? This is what I do, this is what I specialize in. And then the Windows app is for recruiters or the recruiting industry to actually search for bios. And then in this particular case, I have the same TechBio DLL and the same class, obviously, which allows me to search. Right. So if I run this, I'm actually starting this application locally here, and I'm going to be able to search for, let's say, I'm looking for SQL Server people that are really strong, and I have a convention here to establish what strong means, and that know C sharp, perhaps. And I press enter. I establish a connection to the cloud directly as an ADO.NET connection. I retrieve the code, right, all the data that's being searched. The searching happens on StoreProc, just returns the data back to me, and I display it in the user interface. And to make sure I don't return 2 million rows, because I'm going to pay for 2 million rows, I have a top something, top 50 or top 100. Right. And this, it was pretty fast, right? I mean, I returned like 20 records. You know, let's do that again. No, it's pretty decent. Now, of course, you've got this question of performance, right? So multiple things will affect your performance. The connection to SQL Azure is entirely encrypted from beginning to end. In SQL 2008, what was encrypted by default was just the login packets, the pre-login packets. After that, it was, you know, it was basically you could sniff it and see what was happening. SQL Azure is SSL completely, so it's going to slow you down. It's a remote link, obviously, right? So it's encrypted, remote. You could be throttled, you know, if you don't pay attention to your performance. So there's a lot of things like this to consider in your design. On the other hand, you know, because you can't use CLR, you can't use all those things. It's pretty fast. It's CRUD operation only. It's going to be a pretty fast database backend because that's what it concentrates on. Sir. If the connection comes from Windows Azure, is it still an SSL connection? The answer is yes. Yes. So obviously, there are certain things you need to think about as well from a design standpoint, right? We talked about it. Somebody asked a question earlier about the entity framework. Linking to SQL is the same thing. If you've got a chatty application, a chatty design where you're going to go back and every time you want to fetch data, that's going to be not only slow, but expensive. So, you know, there are certain things we're going to have potentially to include in your design, such as caching is probably going to play a very important role for you. Lazy loading of properties. I know the Entity Framework 4 supports, what's the name of that property, Scott, again? Lazy loading. Okay. You've got, you know, certain type of sharding is going to become important as well if you want to spread your load from and increase performance. If you want to issue the same statement for multiple four databases and concatenate the results, so you've got a few things like this to consider from a design standpoint. Just want to show you as well one more thing. Here I'm connecting to my database through SQL Server Management Studio. As you see. This one that I'm highlighting right now is my database, and I can open a new query. Is this database search view? Here we go. So what happens is in SQL Azure, when you open a connection to your database, because each database could be located on different physical servers for which you really have no visibility, you cannot use the use command to switch database from database to database. You have to disconnect and reconnect to the other database. So understanding which database you're on is really important. And I've made that mistake a couple of times. So you can see at the bottom here, Enzo log is the database name. That's where I'm connected right now. We mentioned earlier that you can do some type of performance tuning on SQL Azure. You can. The one thing you cannot do is running a trace. So you cannot run Profiler and get trace data. Hopefully it will come at some point. But you can do other things. So for instance, you could select and turn on the actual execution plan. Close that. And the execution plan comes back. And you can see that I have an index seek happening. That's because I have my index. Right? This is an index seek. If I drop my index, I think. Oof. And I go do my select again. As you can expect, you'll have an execution plan showing you that you're doing an index scan. So you get graphical support automatically already in SQL Azure to be able to look at your execution plans and do some level of performance tuning. Obviously, I don't know if you've seen the what comes back on the wire or when you trace all the data that's coming back whenever you do a execution plans, but it's a lot of the data. So all that is also coming encrypted, right? So if you've got a really large execution plans, you have to kind of have to be patient. I wanted to show you recently Microsoft added a couple of statements, DMVs for support, so you could see the connections that were established, the most recent sessions, so you can all the requests that came through. So you also have, you know, right now you have the ability to also look at that from certain types of DMVs that are available to you for performance tuning. Not all of them are there. And I'm going to also talk about very quickly the firewall rules. You actually have access. Oh, well. All right. So the firewall rules are available directly on the master database. So here I'm connecting to an Enzo log database, so I cannot access those rules. I have to disconnect and reconnect. No, that's fine. So what I'm going to do now, change connection. And you have to go in the options tab and type the database that you want to connect to. And at this point, I'm connecting to master. You can see this on the bottom right, master. And I should be able to now do a select on my firewall rules. Permission denied. Oh, that's because I'm still looking at my execution plan. There you go. These are all the rules I have currently set up. The rules are available through the management console you've seen earlier, where you can see your Windows Azure projects and your SQL Azure databases. You can manage them from there. Or if you actually have a connection to the database, you can manage them from here as well. So you can view your rules, add your rules, and drop your rules from directly T-SQL in SQL Azure. Sir? Yes. So the first question was, am I connecting to a SQL Azure database right now? The answer is yes. The second question was, if you have multiple databases in the cloud, do you need to have multiple connections? The answer is yes. One connection string per database. So the question is, can you access from one store proc the other store, the other databases? The answer is no, I don't think so. What happens is you need to be able to, you need a native .NET connection to your databases, and right now you don't have support for the CLR. You cannot do a distributed queries either. That's not supported. You know, you have full support for transactions within a database, but doing transactional store procs across databases, that's not supported. Sir? What are the actual limits before you get kicked out? So there. So I don't know the details around all the parameters. This is based on logic that Microsoft has developed to determine, you know, what is your consumption profile for resources that may decide whether or not you're going to get kicked out. I don't know what that looks like. There are a couple of rules, though, for sure. Your idle connections will get kicked out within 30 minutes. So that's a fact. And then if you're, I think there's also a hard rule on how long it takes. If your statement takes more than, forgot what it is, 5 minutes or whatever, you're going to get kicked out as well.
I'll dig into that.
Okay.
Would you also get charged for the data for creating the connection? Anything that goes from time to time?
Yeah, if you're not in Windows Azure in the same geographical location than the database, anything that goes over the wire gets charged outside of the master database. That's my understanding. Mm-hmm. So, but you don't, you know, you have read-only access to the master database, so don't get any ideas. any other questions? Okay. This is my cheat sheet just in case. Let me review quickly. we talked about that. Oh, yeah. There's one more thing. Half of the battle from the performance standpoint is also the experience of the user, right? And I've been in, and I'm sure most of you have as well, been in environments where performance can be also a problem of perception. If you've got an application that's going to wait, and it doesn't matter where you click, the app doesn't respond, your users are going to complain about performance, right? And it might be beautiful in the database, everything might work real nice, but if your app is not responsive, then you'll have the performance issue on your hands. So what this means is that, you know, thinking if you develop a local application on your desktop and you develop WinForm against Azure, whether it's services in Azure, whether it's SQL Azure, your app is probably going to be a little bit slower. There's no doubt about it. And so you may have to build into your app multi-threading initially or right away into your app. Having the ability to have responsive user interfaces is going to become even more important when you code against you know, cloud interfaces. Right. Sir?
Is your connection string different when you're going against the dev fabric locally? Does your connection string have to change the local string?
So the connection string is virtually the same. There are some requirements about which TDS, which libraries you can use. You have to use the latest AD.NET libraries and so on and so forth. But the connection string is almost the same. The server name, though, is a bit longer. You have to have the fully qualified name of the server, a logical server. And you get that into the configuration, the management screens as well. So if I just show you here in the app I have, that's, you know, the connection string here basically is a little longer for it's highlighted. That's the fully qualified server name on the internet. And you start with TCP to make sure there's no TCP is the only method of communication available for SQL Azure. You cannot use anything else but TCP for now. So you specify TCP and then the server name, fully qualified. And that's really the only difference you have.
Scroll right so I can see your password.
I'm going to change it. Sir?
If you have a 1 gig Azure database and you're starting to run out of space and you need to upgrade to a 10 gig, can you upgrade an existing SQL Azure database?
So the question is, if you have a 1 gig database, because that's the way you start, and then you want to upgrade to a 10 gig database, can you upgrade? The answer is yes, as of the last 2 weeks. So yes, you can.
Do you have to upgrade, or does it upgrade you automatically?
Does it upgrade you automatically? No, it does not upgrade automatically. You have to alter your database, I believe.
Yeah.
Can you connect from SQL Azure to a service bus? Is that the question?
Yeah, that's, say, for example, a stored procedure that responds directly to the service bus messages or writes them back out to the service bus.
I do not believe so. I don't know.
No.
I don't know for sure, but I don't think so. No.
No.
Yeah, we require CLR. That's right.
Okay.
So one more question. Yes. Question is, are CTs, common table expressions, supported? The answer is yes, right. All right. Perfect. Thank you very much, Ryan.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
You going to be around after?
Yes, I'm going to be here. I'm going to be around after, and I'll be here if you have any questions later. Thank you.
The best part about this is that he left his connection and everything here, so I get to muck around with it.
And his password.
And his password, yeah.
normally after events, we'll go over to Champs for, sit and talk. So anybody who wants to come over to Champs, I'll drag Hervé over there, and y'all can beat him down, too. So.
Okay, so that was a quick look at SQL Azure and some of the things you could do in SQL Azure. There was one question that said, is it different connecting to your dev fabric than it is out in the cloud? And when you're developing locally, you're going to be connecting directly to a SQL Server instance of your choice. So if you've got a local development server somewhere that you use that has SQL Server on it, that's what you would use. There isn't a local SQL Azure, fabric that you can run. You're just going to connect directly to a SQL Server. And one of the challenges is migration. There are a few options for migration to SQL Azure. You can use scripts, obviously. You can also use BCP or SSIS for integration services. You could do that to migrate data out. There's also a tool up on CodePlex called SQL Azure Migration Wizard. And that's a nice tool for a couple of reasons. One is just easy to run, so creating SSIS packages, especially if you're 99% dev, 1% DBA, it's just nice to run a tool and have it do the work for you. And then the Migration Wizard will also try to, it will look at your script that gets created, and it will try to flag any known incompatibilities of something that won't work out in SQL Azure. It's not 100%, but it's pretty good. So check that project out on CodePlex, and you can see which parts of your schema will work in SQL Azure. Now, the rest of this is talking about more of the native Windows Azure storage options. And to get started with that, you would go into your storage account. Joe showed you that briefly before. And one of the things that we mentioned is that there's a few different options for storage. You have blobs, tables, and queues. So I have to kind of figure out which one to go into first. So I guess we'll just start with tables. And specifically, it's always a little bit interesting to talk about tables because, especially after talking about SQL Azure, because obviously there's a relation there. And the Windows Azure tables are interesting because they're designed to be, I hate to use the word infinite, but infinitely scalable, where we can have a massive amount of entities in table storage, all accessible via REST, and there really isn't an upward bound. So like SQL Azure, you're limited to either a 1 gig database or a 10 gig database. Azure Table Storage doesn't have that notion. So in theory, you could keep putting stuff in there all day long. Now, there is a little bit of a pricing difference, too, but I don't want to dive too far into that until session three when we go into it. Now, there are a few limitations of the tables. Generally speaking, they're very loosely defined because you could take just about any class, and as long as you specify a couple of things, a partition key and a row key, you can put an entity inside an Azure table. So these are the partition key and the row key are up here on this slide. Now, the partition key is really what defines your scalability inside an Azure table, because as you can imagine, if you're inserting tens of thousands of rows or millions or billions of rows, behind the scenes, Azure Table Storage is going to need to know how to partition that data into logical groupings for performance. So you need to specify on your entities a partition key, and it will then store those together. And it's much more efficient. It also enables faster queries, and you can grab data all off the same partition key. Now, row key obviously uniquely identifies a single entity inside of an Azure table. And then the timestamp is managed for you just every time that the row is modified. And then there's any number of properties that match to your entity. So let me give you a demo of what this looks like. All right. So what I'm going to show you here is, I talked a little bit about this already, is the MyWorldMaps.net solution. And first, the concept behind MyWorldMaps.net is you would basically come to the site, get an account, and you would put a geographical hit counter, a little image tag on your site, and then that's what records all the traffic, because when the image tag is requested from the MyWorldMaps.net server, it aggregates that data behind the scenes. Now, as it so happens, I actually use SQL Azure for this data. So, in fact, if I come back in here into SQL Management Studio, you can see that I'll go ahead and I'll make Hervé feel good, and I'll disconnect from his database here. But my database is up over here, and let's wait for this to complete. Now, all my stuff is directly within this database. I have no idea why this is taking so long, but I prefer to use SQL for a few reasons. One is I have a large number of joins that are going on, and so it's a lot more performant for me to define those joins directly within a stored procedure. And with Azure tables, you really don't have that. You can't have joins, and there really isn't any relationship between entities. So we'll just let that guy go. I'm going to come into the solution over here, and every time a hit comes in, then suppose you had that image tag, and you hit the world map server. What's going to happen is eventually that hit. Oh, burn! All right, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, was that from a live meeting?
No, that was from SQL.
Oh, was that SQL? Okay, gotcha. We're just going to close that.
Boy, and there I was going to blame Visual Studio 2010.
Yeah, no. Never blame Visual Studio. So what I've got here is some code directly from the solution, the Azure MyWorldMaps.net solution. And so when a hit comes in, we get ultimately we get this class, which is just a map hit class. And eventually, at some point in time, we're going to go down and insert this hit into the database. And that is using nothing different than a standard SQL connection string. Everything you've seen so far, especially from Hervé's solution there, it's the same concept. But suppose I wanted to change this to use Azure Table Storage. The process is pretty easy. The first thing that you do is any entity that you'd like to store in Table Storage has to derived from table service entity. So we'll do that right here. And once you do that, we need to define a couple of other things. That is that row key and a partition key that I told you about. So what I will do here is in my constructor, we'll come down here and I'll just say this dot partition key. Now, the obvious challenge here is how to partition this data effectively, because in this case, how am I going to want to pull this data out later? Now, every user has an individual ID associated with their map account. So putting all the data in according to their map ID is actually the right way to go here, because that's the data I'm going to pull out later. I want all of, you know, Joe's map data or all of my map data and so on. So in this case, I'll assign the partition key to just be the same thing as the as the map ID that got requested to begin with. So we'll define that there. And in this case, I don't really have a need for a specific row key, so we'll just say GUID.newGUID to string. So once we have a partition key and a row key defined, now, of course, we're going to want to make it so when we go ahead and insert, when we log this hit to the database, in this case, instead of logging it to the database, we're going to log it directly to Azure Table Storage. And the easiest way to do that, I've written something already right here, is we're going to use that storage client API that I told you about that already comes with Windows Azure. And here, what I'm going to do is get a reference to my Azure Storage account. And then what we're going to do is create a table service context. Now, in this case, this table service context, there's a little bit better of a way to do this, and that would be to create a completely separate class that has our context information in it. So it's a little bit like creating a Link to SQL class, where Link to SQL will create classes for all of your entities, but then it creates a completely separate context class for you. So that would be a little bit better way to do it, and I'll show you how we can change this to support that. And then what we're going to do is, on top of our table context, is we're just going to add this instance, this map hit to that context, and then we're just going to call save changes. Now, that will go ahead and add this directly to table storage. So how do we view this? Because we've already talked about blobs, tables, and queues. How do we go in and see all these things? Because what are they? Well, when we run the, you saw this from Joe's first presentations, we have the local development fabric, and we also have the local development storage. What we can do is we can go in there and have a peek into blobs, tables, and queues. What I'm going to show you is one such tool for doing that, and this tool is called Cloud Storage Studio. I'll just refer to it as CSS, but I know it's a terrible, we don't even know the CSS acronym for anything related to the web. But what this tool does is it lets you define some accounts. In this case, I've got the WorldMaps account here, and I also have my DevStore account here. So if I'd like to peek into development storage, I can go ahead and do that. And you can see that we have tables, queues, and containers, which is by blob storage, because blob storage is really a collection of containers. So this tool then allows me to peek into these things. So to show you the containers, just as an example, if I open this up, you'll see that I've got a whole bunch of files in here, like charts, which is all the charts that I store on the website. I have maps, I have image files, everything else. So it is very much like a directory that I can then use, and I can write to it and so on. Now, my queues, I use two queues inside the application. One is called the HitLogger queue, and the other one's a MapWorker queue. And these are both Azure queues. You can think of them as somewhat like MSMQ hosted in the cloud. And then we have the tables. And in this case, we're going to dive into the Windows Azure Diagnostics tables later, but the first one is the MapHits table, and that's the one I just created. And I didn't run this right now, but if I had run this solution, this is what it would look like. Here's our table. And what we have in here is we have our partition key, we have our row key, the timestamp, and then that map hit class itself stored the agent ID, a hit date, an IP address, and then the map ID. Those were the properties within that class. And it will automatically do that for you, right? Where it will assign a column to each property inside your entity. So now to get this data out then, if I'd like to query all this data, one of the things that we're going to have to do is create a little bit more of a robust data service context. And that's actually very easy to do, where what we'll do, because everything is based off of ADO.NET Data Services, so if you've played around with that, you already have a huge head start, because this is the same exact code you would write for your own services. But the easiest way, if you're just interested in querying data, is just to have a method that returns like a queryable. And what this will do is this will let me pass in essentially a link statement that can query a bunch of data back and give it and return it as a query. And it's very very performant over the wire, because we can pass the entire expression back to Azure Table Storage. So we're not doing filtering here. Azure Table Storage will do that for us. And so by doing that, let's go down to the website here, and I'll open up the have all these folders open here. So I have Azure Table Hits right here, and then if I'd like to query that data, it's a pretty simple process. I'll go ahead and uncomment this right here, where we create an instance of our map hit data context. So now we have a little bit more of a rich context object. But then I can say var hits is from h in context.hit select h. So it's a very familiar syntax you might already be used to. And then we could just bind that to our data grid. So to get started using Azure Table Storage, as you can see, it's actually really simple. If you already have a class that represents your data, it's very easy to do this. Not a whole lot of code, and we can be writing data and reading from it right away. Of course, if we were using SQL Azure, it's a little bit more complicated because now I have to create the tables in SQL Azure to hold the data, the sprocs to read and write from that, ideally, and then I have to create the code, you know, or use CodeGen to do that inside inside my app. So it's a lot more efficient. So we can eliminate that. Now there's a few things to talk about the way that the way Azure tables work, also queues and blobs, is they work off of a transaction principle where every transaction against blob tables and queues counts as a transaction charge against your account. So if I do this, if I were to run this one query here, that would be considered a transaction. Likewise, when my map hit tries to save itself right here where it inserts this one row, that counts as a transaction as well. And transactions are billed at one penny for every 10,000 transactions. So it's a little bit different of a model compared to, say, SQL Azure, where you're not billed for transactions. You're just billed a monthly fee to use the service. So we'll dive more into that later on as well. So one of the things that, moving on from table storage, is, and we'll come back to the Azure diagnostic stuff in the next talk, but we also talked about queues. In this case, I'm using two different queues. And queues are a great way to create a messaging system between two different roles. So, for example, you might have a worker role that's listening to messages coming off of a queue and need to process that somehow. So queues are a great way to decouple those. And in this case, every time a hit comes in, I will use the hit logger queue, and I also have a map worker queue to process map redraws because those are cached for quite some time. So what I'm going to do here is we're going to go back to the project. Now, because those queues are getting processed so quickly, the queues are that if I open up that queue, it's probably going to be empty, or I might get one entity in it. So what I'll do is I'll disable within the application. I'm going to tell it this is just an admin function where I tell it to disable hit logging. And so what that's going to do is it's going to allow the app to write to the queue, but it's not going to the worker role. Now we're not going to pull that off of the queue. So if I come back here, I should see these queues starting to fill up pretty quick because this is live data. And let's see what happens. So already in that, 10 seconds, we saw 51 new messages added to the queue. And we'll refresh it again, and now we're up to 75. And so all of these represent hits coming in that need to get data logged into the database. And we can open these up and see the message. And what I do and what I recommend most people do is they basically put you what you do is with a queue message, it's just a text field that you can put data into. So usually what you do is you delimit the data somehow. And so in this case, what the map hit, this is a map hit that's basically put into queue storage. So I've got the map ID of the user, the IP address of the person who visited the site, the user agent ID, in which case user agent 1, whatever that maps to, it might be IE8, for example, and then the actual date time of the hit. And so all that gets passed down to the worker who takes this off, parses it, and then goes ahead and does that insert into the database. So let me show you what this code looks like because it's pretty straightforward. So the first thing is the code, and tell you what I'll do is just to keep things rolling here, I'll go ahead and re-enable this. One time I kept this disabled by accident over about a 24-hour period, and there were, you know, I don't a lot in there, a couple, you know, over 100,000 or something like that in there. But the nice thing is it is scalable, so you should be able to hold that. So I put that one to the test. So in this case, here we go again with our MapHit class where we're calling this method add to Azure queue, we pass in a message. So instead of having to make an HTTP call directly to queue storage, we'll again use the storage client to map some of that for us. And as you can see, there's not a whole lot of code here. We just create a new cloud queue message, and we'll make it a string. In this case, you pass in the constructor, you can put in the string. And so my hit, class here, it overrides ToString and it automatically will pipe to limit that data. And then we'll just add that one message to the queue. In this case, you can see hit logger queue.add message. And the hit logger queue is created when my role first spins up. So it's a static reference that stays there for the lifetime of the application. So that's all there is to it. Now, the hit queue processor, on the other hand, what this does is this will come through, and this is now running either in a separate VM or running somewhere else. It doesn't really matter. But we have a cloud queue message here where we just call queue.getMessage. Now, with the queue, one of the things that you have to do is you have to figure out how long do I want to hold on to that message before somebody else has a chance to process it. Because the idea here is what happens if you pull a message off of the queue and then your process crashes halfway through. So you need to make that message visible again if you're going to make it durable. And that's what queue storage does for you, is that it makes everything durable, but it needs to know how long it should hold on to that message. So you do that by passing in a time span in the constructor. Now, if you don't do this, the default is 30 seconds. So you're going to run into a problem if you've got a long-running process that might take, say, 5 or 10 minutes off of a queue message. You're going to run into a problem because if you don't pass in a high enough time span, queue storage is going to assume that you crashed, and it's going to put that message back. It's going to mark it as visible, and then somebody else can come along and grab that message off the queue. So you want to make sure that you have a valid enough time to process whatever message it is in the queue. And then what we do is we just come down and we now parse that back. So we take that pipe to limited value and turn it back into an actual hit. We'll go ahead and call log hit, which will either put it in Azure Table Storage or, in my case, into SQL Azure right here. And then the most important thing to do is you call queue.delete message. And in this case, what this will do is this will go ahead and delete the message from the queue and remove it, forever. Now, if we run into an exception at some point here, if something happened where it was a completely unexpected scenario, one of the nice things we can do is we can access the dequeue count property, which tells you how many times has this message already been dequeued. And if it's been dequeued a large number of times, odds are you have what we call a poison message, which is something that your app is crashing over and over again trying to process it. So if that happens here, I'm just going to delete it. I don't need to, there's nothing I could do. It's automated code, so I'm just going to delete the message from the queue. So that's a quick look at Azure queues and how those work. And if I go back here now to Cloud Storage Studio. Hopefully we'll have these, should be empty now.
To give a shameless plug for the training kit, if you go in and you do the building the guestbook demo or you just rip down the code, it's got a good queue example in there as well. And when it builds the Azure for guestbook, essentially, it puts in a link to a photo out in the queue, and then use a background task to generate a thumbnail and then upgrades the settings and refresh in the update panel. But, there's some good walkthroughs in that training kit on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a ton of samples all within the training kit that go into these a little bit deeper than we're able to today, so to really get into the nuts and bolts of queues, tables, and so on. Now, some of the biggest questions then, of course, that I mentioned earlier is about how to choose between Azure Tables and SQL Azure. Some of it is technology-based because some can do things better than the other, right? So that might be a driving factor for you. In my world maps, that's something that was really important for the application was I needed to do joins against tables, and it's a lot of data. So the semi-structured nature of Windows Azure Tables didn't really work for me. Now, the other thing that might determine whether or not you use Azure Tables or SQL Azure would be price. And we'll get into that in the next section too, because in some situations, Azure Table Storage might be substantially cheaper. In some cases, it might not be. So we'll get into that next. But just to wrap up this session, and I wouldn't have too much time to go into it, but does anybody have any questions on some of the data storage options? Yes, go ahead. Does the partition key and the row key have to be globally unique? The row key does. inside a given partition key, but the partition key does not. So, for example, you might choose a partition key that says, okay, if you've got, say, a huge catalog of items, and you know, I might say, okay, this partition key is for jeans in my catalog, and this one's for shirts. You could use that as a partition key, depending on how much data you have, and then a row key then that matches one item within that partition key. Yes. Yeah, so the question is, can you, yeah, that's a good point. Yes, so the question is, can you edit a table row? And the answer is yes, absolutely. You can just, in fact, just like working with any data context object, you could pull it out, and the data service context class there would need to be have that implementation in there to call save changes on top of an entity where it will go back and save it and update it. But yeah, absolutely. And the training kit has some of that in there to show you how to update entities as well. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Anything from our live friends there that's been interesting?
There we go. Main stuff has been where the presentation is going to be.
Okay.
And what I've told people live is in my blog post, I will put in links to your stuff and then Hervé's presentations. Right, Hervé? Yeah. All right.